what does understanding how humans evolved reveal about how we make money decisions? A few months ago, I spoke with Michael Shermer, author of The Mind of the Market, Compassionate Apes, Competitive Humans, and Other Tales from Evolutionary Economics. Listeners told us that they really enjoyed that segment, so we're airing it again today. I started out by asking him, haven't economists argued that our economic decisions are based mostly on logic and reason?
They have, yes. In fact, this is a model called only half tongue-in-cheek, a homo economicus, you know, economic man. And the idea basically, the theory has three points, that people are rational decision makers and that we're largely free to make choices that we want. And that we do so in a way that will maximize our benefits, or what they call utility. And it turns out that all three of these are false. This whole thing is a myth. We are very emotional, irrational. We're not very free. I mean, we're highly manipulated by advertising and market forces,
not saying that it wouldn't be good if we really could work largely from logic and reason, but you're saying that it's very difficult for us to do
that.
It
is, and we don't. And if you stop to think about it for a moment, considering what else I do, you know, at Skeptic Magazine, the study of irrational behavior, this is what we do. And why should it be that we know people are so irrational in all aspects of life, why suddenly would we become logical and rational when we walk into a supermarket or buy some stocks on the stock market? There's no reason to think that the normal cognitive and psychological biases and effects that we study wouldn't also apply there, and of course they do.
But of course, people in general think that all of our behavior is as rational as possible.
Well, yeah, that's, of course, after that itself is a fallacy, where it's, you know, after the fact reasoning, we justify our actions and beliefs with sound logic, but we've already made the decision what we're going to believe. This is true in politics and religion and any kind of attitudes and beliefs we hold. Mostly we arrive at those for emotional reasons or social, psychological reasons, and then we back into it with, here are my six reasons I believe this, you know. And everybody does. It's called confirmation bias, where you look for and find confirmatory evidence for what you already believe. So let's say you invest in a stock. Once you've made the investment, you will then go back and justify why you did it, although you may do it because you think iPods are cool, so you bought Apple, or you love surfing Google, so you buy Google stock, something like that. Then other things also kick in, like the endowment effect. We always cherish and value more whatever it is we already own, and value it much less if somebody else owns it, we're going to buy it. Well, this is dangerous when you own stocks that you probably should be dumping, because we have something of an endowment of it simply by the fact that we own it. And then we also have this sunk cost fallacy, where once we sink a lot of cost or money into something, and not just stocks, could be a business, a relationship, a marriage, we tend to hang on to those things probably too long, simply because of this endowment effect, and also that we feel like we've spent so much, like the war. You know, this has always been the justification of keeping it going. Look, we can't back out now. We've spent this much money. This many people have died. When in fact what we should be doing, if we were really rational, is saying from this day forward, is it worth spending this much?
This is what also keeps people gambling in Las Vegas.
Oh, absolutely.
I've already lost $1,000. I got to get my money back.
Turns out that people don't need people and rats and pigeons and all other animals don't need to be paid off every time. Just periodic reinforcement, as Skinner discovered. You only have to pay off the pigeon every once in a while to keep him pecking the key, or the guy sitting there at the slot machine. By the way, I should note parenthetically that the slot machines near the windows and doors pay off slightly higher than those on the inside, so that passersby seeing the, you know, slightly more payoffs are more likely to come in and gamble.
And then we have payoff dopamine.
We do. Turns out in my book, I talk about this whole new area of neuroeconomics, in which you do these brain scans and study neurochemicals and what happens when we're, say, gambling, or what happens when we're being very cooperative. And dopamine and oxytocin are these chemicals. Dopamine is sort of this feel-good addiction-type chemical that goes way up when you're having a real positive experience, and this can be a positive economic experience, a positive trade, that sort of thing. Or oxytocin, when people are cooperating in games, and these game theory models that economists use to study how people cooperate or defect. When cooperation is on the rise, there's an increase in oxytocin, which makes people feel good about one another.
And you see all of this as part of the evolutionary process, but you also write there is resistance to applying evolutionary theories to economics and social sciences in general.
There is. And one of the things I hope to accomplish with The Mind of the Market is to convince liberals that free market capitalism is not as evil as they think, and to convince conservatives that evolution is not as evil as people think. That is, these are both examples, evolution and economics, of bottom-up, self-organized principles. So simple life evolves into complex life without a top-down designer. And you and I just out making a living and making trades and buying and selling stuff, this naturally evolves into a complex economy without a top-down designer. Now, of course, in the case of economics, you need some kind of social system in which the market operates. You need
because the free
democracy.
Market sometimes can go awry.
You need a rule of law in which it can operate with the property rights and rules that we're going to enforce, yes.
The phrase survival of the fittest has become something of a cliche in business boardrooms.
It is. You know, Jeffrey Skilling of Enron fame, his favorite book in Harvard Business School, he said, was Richard Dawkins, The Selfish Gene. Well, this is something of a misreading of Darwin's theory. It's not just that animals are competitive and cutthroat and nature is nasty, brutish and short and red and tooth and claw and all that. That's only part of nature. The other part is social animals are incredibly cooperative and altruistic. And most businesses are like that. If most businesses were like Enron, we wouldn't have a market economy.
My guest is Michael Shermer, Shermer. His latest book is called The Mind of the Market, Compassionate Apes, Competitive Humans, and Other Tales from Evolutionary Economics. It's published by Times Books. So what does the mind of the market mean? Can a market have a mind?
Well, it does. In fact, I was just thinking about this morning that there's something called the Matthew effect from the Gospel of Matthew. To those who have, more shall be given, and to those who don't, even what they have shall be taken away. This is famous Jesus' parable of the talents and the Sermon on the Mount. But marketers, the Matthew effect is that, say, for example, in science, the most famous scientists get the most credit for discoveries, even though their graduate students do most of the work. Marketers call this cumulative advantage. Anytime a product gets a slight head start in a marketplace, it gains cumulative advantage by the fact that more people are paying attention to it, which draws more sales. This is why authors like me do these book tours. You hope to get a little bit of cumulative advantage over the other books and get some momentum going. And, of course, this is why politicians hit the campaign trail. We saw this with Barack Obama, when he got that little hit in Iowa, boom, all of a sudden he's on the cover of every newspaper the next morning, and all the pundits are saying, no, he's the man, he's the guy. That sends a signal to you and I and everybody else out there. That guy is now, he's our man, and that, so you get a snowballing effect. That is, if you think of the political landscape as a market.
But those magazines obviously didn't sell in New Hampshire. Or didn't sell as well as they
might.
So
this, of course, can go back and forth. And it's not that candidates don't have something of substance and something to say that we believe in or whatever. Yes, of course. But there's something else going on. And so, for example, these download rates of songs, like on iTunes, for example, or on Amazon, the rankings, those create a kind of a mind of a market in the sense that there's a cumulative advantage to having a book that moves up the charts, or a DVD or a CD that moves up the charts, and it sends a signal for more people to buy it, which pushes it further up the charts, and you get that cumulative advantage of that Matthew effect.
Let's go back. Your subtitle is Compassionate Apes. So you're suggesting that we inherited an awful lot of our behavior from apes, and you look at all of the research into ape behavior. What did Franz de Waal and Keith Chen and others?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting that, of course, we are primates, so it's hard for us to remember that, but it's true. So naturally, we shouldn't be surprised when other primates do this sort of thing. Like, for example,
do they have an economy? Do apes have economies?
Well, if you think of an economy as a social structure in which organisms are interacting and exchanging things. So let's say that in primitive societies, it might be feasting, like the potlatch. Basically, what a potlatch does is it by my throwing a big feast for you, it obligates you. This is a form of what's called reciprocal altruism. I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine. So by putting that signal out, it's like when marketers do a mailing and they put a dollar bill in there, and you take the dollar bill, it triggers something in your brain to make you feel like, I need to reciprocate for this, and fill out that form and send it in. That's called reciprocal altruism, and marketers know that, they play on it. Well, it turns out that there's this interesting game called the ultimatum game. Let's say I give you and your producer, I give you $100, and you can make an offer to your producer to split it. And if he accepts the offer, let's say you offer him 50-50 and he accepts it, you both get to keep the whole $100. And if he rejects the offer, neither of you get any money. So what are you going to offer him? Well, homo economicus theory says that you should offer him like 10 bucks and you keep 90. Because he's not going to get anything anyway. So he gets a free 10 bucks. Why wouldn't he take it? In fact, almost all subjects reject the 10 bucks. Why? Because it's not fair. Well, but wait, who says it's not fair? Well, there's no rule about the ultimatum game or law. This is deep in our evolutionary heritage. And
I mean, apes would respond the
chimpanzees
same way?
And capuchin monkeys. Capuchin monkeys have pretty small brains. They react in the same way. It's a different kind of setup. Obviously, you're using pieces of fruit rather than money. But they exchange. I mean, the whole business of primates grooming, of, yes, of course, it takes ticks off or whatever. There's a health reason going there. But it does something much more than that. It has to do with give and take social exchanges.
So they barter and then they provide services.
They do. In fact, there was a study that found chimpanzees that groom one another are more likely to help one another in a fight, particularly two males.
And the Yale economist Keith Chen discovered that capuchin monkeys understand the concept of supply and demand.
They do. You train these monkeys to exchange these little stones for fruit that they like. And it could be sliced banana or sliced apples or whatever. And so let's say you have to give the experimenter two stones to get one slice of apple and two stones to get one slice of banana. And then in the second round, you've doubled the price of the banana. Now he has to give four stones to get the banana and two stones to get the apple. Well, supply and demand, all of a sudden the price goes up. The value, perceived value and demand by the monkey will go down. Predictably so, in exactly the same manner of humans.
Now, how does the new scientific theory about mirror neurons come into this picture?
Well, here's the problem we have to explain. Why would I be cooperative and nice and pro-social and altruistic to you, a complete stranger I don't know? You can certainly explain why I would do it for my brothers.
I'm still waiting for that $100.
Well, we'll settle that after the interview here.
My producer will settle for 40.
See, now, that would be typical if he took 40. He might even take 30, but below that, he may get upset about that. So, and what is he telling us? Okay, he will accept the 30. All right. Okay,
we're talking about mirror neurons.
Oh, the mirror neurons.
Theory of
well,
mind.
In order for strangers to exchange and trade, there has to be a system of trust set up. And it begins with a theory of mind. That is, I know that you know that I know that we're in this system or whatever. And mirror neurons, they fire in the brain whenever we imitate somebody else or feel what they're feeling, that sort of thing. A literal sense of empathy. Do you know that Adam Smith's first book, Before the Wealth of Nations, that put him on the map, his first book was called A Theory of Moral Sentiments, Moral Emotions, basically. And he said that people have genuine empathy. They really do feel each other's pains. And that is the basis of a social society. You can't have a society in which we all just have no sense of each other's pains and pleasures. And so that's the basis of a market economy. Not just free market capitalism. You have to have something deeper. And so scientists, neuroeconomists have discovered these mirror neurons that fire. And there's even some new research now about autism in which it's possible autistic kids either don't have mirror neurons or their mirror neurons aren't working quite right. And they literally do not sense that somebody else has a mind, somebody else feels what they feel. And that's why they have trouble looking at somebody else in the eyes. So when we look at each other, there's the eye gaze that triggers these mirror neurons that we've connected. We've recognized each other as individuals and so forth.
And how does this affect the market?
Well, the basis of trade, as I said, there has to be trust. So we have to be able to know what we're doing. So that's the very basis of it. And as well, you need a whole bunch of other things. You need a market set in a society with a rule of law. You have to have protection of civil liberties. You need an infrastructure that works. The bridges don't collapse.
And how far back does that go? Does that go back to our long history as hunter-gatherers?
Yeah, in the sense that, for example, if we take a hunter-gatherer society today, the Yanomamo people I discuss in The Mind of the Market
from the Amazon, how
they do it. Yeah, from the Amazon. They do trade a fair amount, not because they're nascent capitalists or they're innate altruists. They trade for political alliances. So when, let's say, Group A goes to Group B, and they do a little reciprocal feasting for each other. The reason they usually do that is because there's some other group that they don't like, that they're worried about, that has too much power. So it's a power thing. It's a Machiavellian power thing. But the unintended consequences of these Yanomamo people trading is that they each get, there's more of a division of labor, they get more products, they develop trust between one another, the strangers, they fight less, those two groups fight less.
But this all suggests long-range thinking, but it seems to me most people engage in short-term thinking. If a batter, a baseball player, goes into a slump, George Steinbrenner says, trade him, send him down to the minors, or or somebody's stock goes down a few points, and says, uh-oh, I'm in real trouble, sell it. They don't think, well, gee, if I wait a little while, maybe it'll go back up.
Yes, that time is a huge factor, and actually in the Mind of the Market, I have a whole chapter on that, how we discount time, and people are too short-term thinking. There's studies showing that if in the last 30 years in the market, say, for example, if you constantly bought and sell stocks like you were gambling, which is what a lot of people do, you will likely have missed the 40 biggest trade days. If you miss those 40 biggest trade days, you've missed the entire growth of the market in 30 years, and so you can't do that.
You open the book with the argument that in economics, as with evolution, those with more already are often predisposed to get further ahead. In other words, the rich get rich and the poor get poorer.
It's true. And I guess I think one of the deeper things in our brains is that that doesn't seem right. And the reason for this is because most of these hunter-gatherer societies in which we evolved are egalitarian. So the idea of like cumulative wealth and great disparity between the rich and poor is very counterintuitive, and we don't like it. And so we look for solutions for that because it doesn't seem right for somebody to have so much money and other people not to have that. The reason for that is not because somebody's an evil liberal or something. It's all of us feel that way. This is why the richest capitalists give away so much of their money. Even if you want to call it capitalistic guilt or something, why would the guilt be there in the first place? And that emotion is there for a reason. We evolved as largely egalitarian communities. And so the mutual exchange of products and wealth, because there wasn't much, is pretty normal. And hoarding, let's face it, before the modern world, before even, say, the last century, anybody that was extremely wealthy probably got it through ill-gotten gains, as it were. And the whole idea of a free and fair market is fairly new, just the last couple hundred years that we've begun to develop how that should operate fairly.
And even then, we've had our robber barons and continue to have people who are
equivalent. Yes. So those checks and balances are there. I tend to think that we interfere a bit too much in the marketplace. I mean, there's reasons why we have, and I think we can, if we look at capitalism more in terms of like Google, you know, just trying to do the right thing and also make a profit versus Enron. Most companies are more like Google. If most companies were like Enron, it would have ended long ago.
The Mind of the Market, Compassionate Apes, Competitive Humans, and Other Tales from Evolutionary Economics, published by Henry Holt. Thank you so much for being with us again.